Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. Whether you are a student prepping for tests and boards or a CRNA here to earn CEUs, we are glad you've joined us. For more about us, make sure to check us out on Instagram at Core Anesthesia and online at coreanesthesia.com.
Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. My name is Cole here with Tanner, and today we want to move our discussion into non-opioid anesthesia. And I think we all know that it is growing in at least America, the idea of shying away from giving patients too many opioids during their hospitalization, the recovery, just with the risk of addiction and just the things that we've seen in the last decade in our country. There's been a push to use different alternatives and different ways of doing anesthesia from a pain management standpoint. And while by no means are Tanner and I against using opioids at all, we really want to make this talk an idea of how do you supplement other things with the opioids that you give in order to limit the amount of narcotics that we're giving these patients. In some cases, you may want to be completely opioid free. In a lot of cases, it's just simply what are some adjunct medications that we can use or therapy that we can do to limit the amount of opioids that we're having to use on these patients. So that's really the idea of what we want to make this talk about. We're going to go through different forms of both medications, interventions, what are the different available options that we have to limit the amount of opioids that we use in our anesthesia practice.
Like Cole mentioned, there's a lot of reasons that you may want to reduce or even eliminate opioids altogether while you're managing the anesthetic care for a patient. And, you know, there's some pressure, like Cole said, to minimize the use of opioids simply because of all of the problems that we see with opioid abuse, and then just trying to limit the amount that we're, you know, feeding into that. And there's different speculation and different conclusions about how much the, you know, amount of opioids that we prescribe in the hospital setting relates to opioid abuse problems outside of the hospital setting. Regardless, there's still other issues or maybe other patient-specific problems or characteristics that would, you know, warrant you to use other types of medications instead of just using strictly opioids to manage pain. We talk about in our pain pathway discussion how there's, you know, lots of different receptors and lots of different things that feed into the pain pathway. We, you know, even when we talk about PONV, we can attack it from many different ways. And, you know, it doesn't make sense to just give somebody Zofran when there's other ways that we could block the nausea pathway. And there's other things that we could, you know, cover other receptors that we could cover. In the same way, it doesn't make a ton of sense to just only treat pain from one set of receptors and try to block it from one point of view. And we have other options. We have other medications that we can use. And so it just makes sense that we would try to attack the pain from multiple different ways. This also, you know, benefits by reducing the amount of opioids that you would need to use. And especially in certain populations, that's going to be very helpful. I think you often think about patients that have previous opioid abuse, and maybe they have specifically asked for less opioids or no opioids. Maybe you have somebody who has just a really, really high need for pain control. Maybe they have, you know, chronic pain, fibromyalgia, other issues that would, you know, make it so that we're going to need to attack this from several different angles. That would be a patient population where using these other options would totally make sense. You also have people that are, you know, probably more susceptible to the effects of opioids. You think about people that have COPD or sleep apnea, and often you're really concerned about what they look like in PACU if you've given them a bunch of narcotics and you know, you're trying to manage their pain, but now you're also dealing with respiratory issues. You think also in the elderly or pediatric populations. Often too, I mentioned PONV earlier, just kind of as a side note when talking about the different receptors, but a lot of times you'll have people that, you know, the anesthesia gas will make them feel, you know, kind of gross, and they'll have issues with the PONV. And then also sometimes it's the narcotics, you know, after you get them through the anesthesia and now you're trying to manage their pain. Now the narcotics are actually making them feel pretty crummy and they don't like how they feel with that. And so if we can attack their pain from, you know, other receptors, use other adjuncts to manage their pain, you know, there's just a lot of good reasons for why this would be utilized and why this is important. So like Cole said, we're not trying to say opioids are bad or we're trying to do away with them completely. It's just important that we have, you know, a good grasp on the different options that we have to supplement or work together with the opioids.
The first medication we want to talk about is ketamine. Ketamine is a drug that both Tanner and I use quite frequently. I think it's a great adjunct to use in my anesthetic. I've had a lot of success with it, but there are definitely things that you need to be aware of when you're using ketamine. So what is ketamine, first of all? So it is an NMDA or a NMDA antagonist in the brain and pain pathway that causes a depressant effect by blocking these signals going through. So what is a NMDA receptor? It's a receptor that is a channel receptor, and it allows, when bound by glutamate, positive ions then will flow through that receptor into the cell, cause a depolarization and an action potential. So if we're doing a NMDA antagonist with ketamine, we're going to be blocking this, and we're going to be blocking this signal from moving forward. It's metabolized by the P450 in the liver. It does have an active metabolite, norketamine, and that norketamine is renal excreted. So just be aware, when you have anybody with renal failure, that you are going to have that norketamine lasting in their system a little bit longer. So today I actually had a patient that reacted this way to ketamine, but ketamine can make people feel separated from their environment, but maintaining their reflexes. And it's called a dissociative anesthesia effect. If you oftentimes will hear of a patient after getting ketamine will say they almost felt like they were having an out-of-body experience. That's exactly what this guy said today that I took care of. He said that he felt like he was in a video game and was kind of floating around. And it was actually the first patient that I've interacted with that actually has had that reaction and told me about it, which I thought was interesting. But basically, in order to limit the effects of this, we typically give benzos prior to help with any of the hallucinations or emergence delirium that you would have. And again, I gave this guy to a Versed right before I gave the ketamine. But again, it's not a 100% foul proof here. It's just something that will limit the amount of hallucinations that they'll have. So what's nice about ketamine compared to other sedative agents is, again, here that it blocks the pain pathway. So instead of just using propofol for a sedative effect, ketamine has the balance of doing both. It works as both a sedative, but also blocks that pain pathway. So you do get both effects, whereas most of the other sedatives don't have that pain pathway effect here. So that's why it's a great adjunct to use with the opioids. I use it in max. I use it in generals. And Tanner, I don't know if you have a certain preference where you like to use it in, but I kind of use it all over the board.
Yeah, often I'll give it up front if I'm doing a bigger case, like before incision. You know, usually I start with like 30 or maybe 50 milligrams for the beginning right before incision. And then I'll kind of work in like 10 at a time throughout the case, maybe every hour or so. The only time I really like to use it is for EGDs. If you have somebody who's a really, really sick patient and they have a lot of cardiac issues, it's nice that it does have the, cardiac protective profile, and it's not going to have the same effects that maybe just doing like straight propofol will. The thing with using it in that scenario is you just really have to talk to them, because like you said, they'll still have, depending on how much you're giving, they're still probably going to be, they're going to have their reflexes. And so I have to tell them, like, when I give them, 30 or 50 for the EGD, then, I just need you to really focus on swallowing, like as we move the scope down. But then after the scope's passed, they really don't care. And it's not stimulating and it's nice, but that's the other time that I tend to use it. If I'm not doing a big case, then just doing it for like an EGD of somebody that's pretty sick.
That's the exact case I used it on today. I had a guy that was a 60 BMI guy. We're doing an EGD on a quick in and out scope prior to figuring out what he was going to get for his surgery. And so I just used 50 of ketamine on the guy and it worked great. Hardly had to give any propofol. And it's just a lot safer of a way to do it, in my opinion. And the reason why, as Tanner alluded to, ketamine is nice in the fact that it acts as a bronchodilator. So it's really good if you have an asthma patient, a patient who's wheezing. It works the opposite from propofol in the effect that it's going to keep the airway reflexes intact. So you can keep this patient breathing spontaneously, even when you're giving, if you give a significant induction dose of it, you're obviously going to take out their drive to breathe. But in the doses that we're talking about, around 50 milligrams or so, it should not do that. It also increases your SNS. So it's okay to give when patients, especially that have a little bit of a reduction in their heart function, whereas propofol would tank out that cardiac reserve. Ketamine is really nice because it will kind of maintain that a little bit. Do be aware, though, that it does increase pulmonary vascular resistance. So be careful in patients with right ventricular heart failure. I haven't really seen too much issue with this. I still have given it in patients with some degree of right ventricular heart failure or cor pulmonale. I've given it to as well. I haven't seen too much effect. Usually with those patients, you really just want to limit the amount of hypoxia and hypercapnia that they have. That's your really two driving factors to increasing your PVR. But with, I've really given ketamine a lot to these patients, and I haven't seen too many issues at all. The other nice thing is that it does not shift that CO2 response curve like propofol will. So again, I know we're kind of talking right now about the sedative nature of it, but what's great is it keeps them breathing and it also controls their pain to some extent. And so it's a really nice adjunct therapy. However, if you've given it before, you probably know it increases your oral and pulmonary secretions. So what I'll do is I'll give Ropinol right off the bat before I even give ketamine. And so again, with this guy today, the second he rolled through the door, I gave him 0.2 of Ropinol and just had that already getting started before giving that ketamine. Because again, with a EGD procedure, you're already going to have a lot of secretions up there anyway, and the ketamine is just going to enhance that effect. So do be aware of that when giving ketamine, that it is going to increase that pulmonary secretions. The last thing I want to talk about with ketamine too is if you have a BIS monitor on, just know that ketamine can falsely increase your BIS. So if all of a sudden you look over and your BIS monitor is reading above 60 and a couple minutes before it was at 40 and you think they're light, just be careful if you've just given ketamine because it is a falsely elevated reading sometimes. So don't all of a sudden think that maybe your patient's light. It could just be a result of that ketamine.
The next medication that we want to talk about, and often I use this in conjunction with ketamine, is Precedex. I love Precedex. I use it almost every single day, and I think that it has some really nice things that it does for the patients. And I think that if you use correctly, it's just a really slick drug, and it's become one of my favorite drugs to use. I think that it's makes the your wake-ups nicer. I think that it manages your pain from a different perspective. And just overall, I think it's just a really nice drug. So how this works, this is a selective alpha-2 agonist. It will block the presynaptic release of your catecholamines by hyperpolarizing the cell. It causes sedation by working in the pons, and then it can also manage pain by working there in the spinal cord as well. So this is where I think it's pretty slick that you'll have some pain relief as well as causing the sedation that kind of mimics that natural sleep. Again, just seems like it has a lot of nice things going for it. But the main thing I wanted to just touch on there is just to remember it's the presynaptic release. That's where it's going to, I feel like I was asked that question all the time as a student, how Precedex works. And just remember that presynaptic selective alpha-2 agonist. As far as dosing, if you're doing a bolus dose, you can give a 1 mic per kilogram loading dose over about 10 minutes. Usually, if you're going to use this as an adjunct, you don't usually go over 0.5 mics per kilogram. That's kind of my ceiling, unless it's a very long case. I tend to think half mic per kilogram. If you're doing a maintenance dose, usually 0.4 to 0.7 mics per kilogram per hour. If you're going to do that for, I've used that before for like a light MAC. If you're doing a case where they need to be able to be, you know, woken up easily and communicate, or maybe you're doing like an MRI or something where they just need a little bit to help them lay still. Again, I think that's kind of a nice way to do it. It's metabolized by the P450 enzyme. The other thing that you need to keep in mind about it is you can see bradycardia and hypotension. The bradycardia, I think, is the thing that we're all aware of, and it's something that you definitely will see if you're bolusing Precedex. But you also should know that you can see hypertension if you're rapidly bolusing it, and that's going to be very short-lived. That's only due to the peripheral stimulation of the alpha-2 receptors, which will cause vasoconstriction. That's where you see the hypertension. But then the central receptors are going to take over, central stimulation is going to take over, and that's going to cause your hypotension. It doesn't really have respiratory depression. In fact, sometimes you can see a little bit of like a tachypnea picture with the Precedex. Obviously, if you give enough of any of the drugs, probably you're going to see some respiratory depression, but typically this is not associated with respiratory depression. It also decreases cerebral blood flow because of cerebral vasoconstriction, but you're not going to see a change in your ICP or your CMRO2. I mentioned this just previously, but the sedation is going to resemble natural sleep because you have decreased SNS tone and decreased level of arousal. This is a nice thing to use for this reason for if somebody has emergence delirium. There's also studies out there that talk about for elderly patients, they look at Versed versus Precedex as far as delirium after anesthesia. And they actually found that the Precedex was better at decreasing post-op delirium than giving Versed. That makes total sense. But then they did Precedex versus no medications, and that actually had still decreased post-op delirium, adding the Precedex compared to not giving them any of those medications. So if I have an older patient, I tend to try to give them just a little bit of Precedex, and you know, I can't really say that I've seen like a huge change, but it's just something that I keep in the back of my mind. You'll also see anti-shivering and analgesia from the alpha 2 in the dorsal horn. This is what we're talking about in the spinal cord. And then the last thing, and this is a little bit controversial, but it does not impair evoked potentials. So if you have those monitors, this is still safe to use for the Precedex. Again, there's a million different ways that you can dose all of these. And you know, we mentioned a little bit of how we dose ketamine when we were talking about that. For me, Precedex is hit or miss, again, as far as how you're going to dose it. And there's a couple things that I'll say about it. You need to know that it's going to last a little while. And so if you're giving big boluses of Precedex towards the end of a case, you could have a risk where they're going to be very sleepy and somnolent and pack you. Or if you're running a drip and you don't shut that off early enough, you really need to make sure you shut that off well before the end of the case, especially if you're doing like a really long case. Otherwise, this is just going to hang around for too long. And then you're going to have a patient that's not really waking up and pack you. The other side of that I just want to mention here quickly is that it does resemble natural sleep, and people are very comfortable when they have Precedex on board. So if I drop somebody off in PACU, I always make sure to verbalize to the PACU nurse that they have Precedex on board. They're going to be sleepy. They're going to be comfortable. But really, if they would talk to them, they're going to wake up and open their eyes typically. And so I like to mention that because you could walk by the PACU bay and look in there and think, oh, that patient's like completely narcotized, has the oral airway in their mouth, and they are just, you know, gorked in PACU. And really, that could be the case if they have a ton of Dilaudid on board. But if that's a Precedex picture, you walk over there and you say their name, they're probably going to open their eyes. They're just very comfortable and sleeping. And so that oral airway is not really bothering them. And if you don't, you know, walk over there and keep stimulating them and talking to them, they're going to want to fall back to sleep. And then they can just take up time in the PACU. So I think that's something that's important, because I think Precedex gets a bad rap for like, all these patients are just going to sleep the rest of the day and PACU. And they could, but if you keep rounding on them and making sure that they, you know, are following commands and talking, they're going to wake up really pretty quickly, and it's not going to be such an issue. They're just going to be very comfortable and desire to sleep or want to fall back to sleep. So I always just make sure I communicate that to PACU nurses so that, they're just not sleeping in PACU. For me, usually for dosing, I'll give up to like 20 mics before incision, and then just bolus 2 to 4 mics every 30 minutes or so. Again, up to that half a mic per kilogram. Or if you're doing it for wake up, usually just like 4 to 8 mics before waking up is enough to get them to be comfortable and you know, wake up feeling nice and comfortable.
Yeah, I'm the same way when it comes to dosing. Maybe not quite as much before incision. I try to work in like 20 throughout. Again, depending on weight, though, obviously, but usually about 20 mics throughout a longer case. But I like to hold off about 4 to 8, as Tanner said, for my wake up. But even after they have been extubated, if the patient's kind of a little agitated, not really cooperating, I'll just give them 4 mics of Precedex. And typically that just chills them out before we go to PACU, and it makes the transition a lot smoother. Rather than me hitting them up with more opioids before we take them down. Again, it's a case-by-case basis. So there obviously is going to be patients where I'm giving more opioids to while I'm taking them down to recovery if I feel like they need it. But more times than not, that 4 mics of Precedex really does a big difference.
Yeah, I remember in school, everybody tells you wake-ups are going to be the hardest part of your anesthetic. And like one of my very early rotations used Precedex all the time. And so then I began thinking like, man, wake ups are easy. you know, like these patients are all really comfortable. I just pull the tube, they open their eyes. And then I went to another place that didn't use Precedex and I'm like, oh, I am not good at this. I have no idea how to time my gas coming off. And I was so dependent on the Precedex because it really does make such a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's like, if you get really comfortable using it and then all of a sudden you don't have to use it anymore. I was like, I was very aware of how terrible I was at waking patients up when I didn't get to use Precedex, but I love it. I think it just makes it so smooth for the patient, I think.
And that was the thing too, going through school, I was with a lot of preceptors that were very anti-Precedex. And when I asked them why, most of the time it was because they said the patients will not wake up. They'll be way too sleepy. And again, I think that all falls back on knowing how to dose it and when to give it throughout a case. You're not going to be giving up to a half mics per kilogram in the last 20 minutes before they wake up. And again, if you have a drip, you got to turn it off ahead of time. But if you time it appropriately, it really does make a huge difference. Just like Tanner, I use it every day. Ketamine and Precedex, I pretty much use daily in my practice. And I really do see a significant decrease in the amount of opioids that I've been using. Again, I'm not trying to be opioid free by any means. I still give opioids almost every case, but it's something where I've limited my opioids to almost half of what I was giving just simply by adding ketamine and Precedex to my typical anesthesia plan.
Yeah, I'll just briefly mention my one Precedex horror story was that I was in school and I had this patient who had all these comorbidities and I'd done all this research and I was like, I show up the morning of with my preceptor. I'm like, hey, this is what I'm going to do. I've got this Precedex drip. I've got this lidocaine drip. I'm going to use MAG. I'm going to use ketamine, all these things mixed together. I'm going to run some propofol. It was like a 7-hour case. And the patient, I think, was like 94 years old. And I definitely ran that whole thing the entire time. And I go to wake him up. And the patient woke up like a day later in ICU. They just like it would not clear. And I'd ran them so heavy for so long and I did not turn it off. Like when we say turn it off early, like turn it off early, especially when you have these longer cases. And who knows if it was the Precedex or just being 93 years old. But I definitely will never forget that. That was a walk of shame to the ICU to be able to check on my patient. They're like, well, still sleeping, still intubated. So I always keep that in the back of my mind if I'm ever running like a Precedex drip, just to, especially on those longer cases, make sure you have time to let that wear off.
Yeah, but don't shy away from using it on those longer cases, especially those back cases that you have neuromonitoring going on. Again, as we said earlier, it's kind of controversial in terms of does it impair evoked potentials or not. Some of the monitoring technicians that you'll have will tell you not to use it. Most that I interact with are totally fine with it. I love Precedex for that standpoint because it's not only a sedative to act as an anesthesia medication, but it also is a pain medication. So I know a lot of my colleagues will just simply run propofol up to half mac and then give the anesthesia gas half mac. But I like to add that Precedex drip in and do less propofol. And I honestly think it works better in the long run. But again, this is something that you do you in your practice. If you want to introduce it, do that. If not, there's going to be several other things that we'll talk about here moving forward, which brings us to our next medication. And it's actually something I don't use quite as frequently in my practice. I'm not sure about you, Tanner, but that's magnesium. And magnesium is, while itself not a primary analgesic medication, it really helps to be used as an adjunct and it decreases the need for opioids. And the reason why is magnesium sulfate has been used to blunt the body's reflexes to noxious stimuli. As a result, it decreases the amount of muscle relaxant you'll need, the amount of anesthesia that you actually need. It also blocks the NMDA receptor that we talked about, just like ketamine. And it also acts as a calcium channel blocker, specifically at the presynaptic nerve terminals. So this is at the nerve terminals we're talking about that are going to be releasing acetylcholine to go to the muscle cells. So think about if you're picturing this in your head when we talk about neuromuscular blockers and how the nicotinic receptors work and that kind of thing. The presynaptic nerve at the end, at that nerve terminal, you have a calcium receptor that when it's activated, it's going to release the packaging of the acetylcholine, which goes out and goes across the muscle and binds to those nicotinic receptors and causes the muscle to contract. Well, if the magnesium is blocking that calcium channel on that nerve terminal, it reduces then the amount of acetylcholine being released. So in essence, it acts as a non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocker in a way. So you'll see a big reduction in the amount of that you'll be using, as well as the amount of anesthesia, gas, and any drips that you'd be using to keep the patient asleep. So why it by itself isn't necessarily a huge primary analgesic medication, it really has this all-encompassing effect by both decreasing the amount of needs for opioids due to that stimuli being blunted, the reflexes from that, as well as all of this reduction in anesthesia that's actually needed. So the dosing for this, and again, I don't do this typically in my practice that often to tell you what I personally use. So again, Tanner, pitch in if you have anything here on this. But the times that I have used it when I was in school and I was with preceptors that used it, we would give anywhere from 1 to 4 grams. I often see 2 grams. That's usually the typical that people use. Typically at the front end of the procedure, most often I would give it between induction and incision. And you can also do a loading dose from what I've read, 30 to 50 milligrams per kilogram, with a maintenance drip then of 6 to 20 milligrams per kilogram per hour. Again, I feel like a lot of people that I interacted with that have done this, they simply give a single bolus dose up front, and then they just let that ride throughout the rest of the case. Small doses of magnesium sulfate has also been shown when you add it to local anesthetic. Say you're doing a spinal anesthetic and you've mixed in magnesium sulfite to it, it's been shown to prolong the duration of action of that anesthetic. Even peripheral nerve blocks, I believe as well, I've read, have seen to increase the duration of action when you add magnesium to it. And as always, I'm sure this is dinging in your head here. If you've listened to our other episodes where we've talked about magnesium, there's a whole slew of different signs and symptoms you need to watch out for with toxicity. And so while I won't go into all the details of that right now, I'll refer you to our other episodes where we talk about that. We talk more about it in our electrolyte presentation, also in our OB episodes, et cetera. But really the normal serum level, and there's different ways you can measure this. So keep in mind the units on this. The normal serum level in millimoles per liter is about 0.7 to 1.1. You start to have toxicity symptoms developed as you get higher than that, and you really start to lose deep tendon reflexes, and you get really dizzy around the 4 to 5 millimoles per liter. You have respiratory arrest when you get above 6 millimoles per liter, and then cardiac arrest when you get above 8 millimoles per liter. And there's obviously a lot more symptoms that go into this that can raise awareness to the toxicity prior to these things happening. And again, refer to our other episodes to get a more detailed description of that. So really, most people I've been with do a single bolus dose up front, anywhere from 1 to 4 grams. I often see 2 grams as usually the typical that people use. If you're just giving 2 grams, you really shouldn't need to watch out too much for the toxicity levels. Again, this is, I think, more commonly seen with a drip format. But again, it's something that you need to be aware of, that if you're going to be giving heavier doses of this, that we need to keep our minds open to.
Yeah, for me, I just usually keep it simple. I'll usually give 1 gram, just kind of slowly push, and then I'll put the other gram up into the IV bag, whatever. If I'm going to run that first liter in, I'll just put it into the bag. And so that will just kind of go in within the next, you know, hour or so, depending on how fast I'm going to run that in, or, you know, what the scenario is. I don't think it gets too complicated. Like, you can do that however you want to do it. And whether you do 1, 2 grams, it's not going to be anything too crazy. And so if you want to push it, or you want to put it into, you know, 100 mil bag and drip it in slowly, or if you want to mix it together with other things that we're talking about, if you want to mix it into a bag with some ketamine and some Precedex, you could do that as well. So lots of different ways that you can do it. But yeah, typically you just see, you know, 1 or 2 grams up front. Lidocaine is another thing that I feel like we're seeing more and more of. And I think it has really good effects for the patient. And you see, especially in these like really big abdominal cases, it seems like you'll see a lot better, pain scores and patient satisfaction when you're running the lidocaine. And so we wanted to touch on this too. I know sometimes that, like magnesium, there's other ways you can do this. Either you can do it just as a straight up drip, or you can just put in some lidocaine into, you know, a mix of these other medications and run it all in together kind of as a mixture. But we'll just talk about it briefly about how this works and some of the ways that you could use it. So lidocaine will block the sodium channels in the neurons to minimize pain transmission. We know this from how it works within the nerves. Additionally, lidocaine is going to block your systemic inflammatory responses, the surgical stress. And the nice thing about this is it'll preserve bowel motility. So kind of like we talked about at the very beginning of this discussion, there's lots of different ways that the body is going to feel pain, or a lot of different pathways that are going to finally end up into the final sensation of pain. So here we have, you know, obviously our neurons that are going to be carrying pain transmission, we can block them there. But then also it's important to recognize all the different inflammatory responses that you have throughout your body. And so it's nice that lidocaine will block that as well. And we'll talk about this a little bit later, some other medications that we can use to kind of decrease the inflammation response. And so, I think that's just another cool side of the lidocaine infusion. Like I mentioned, this can be used for longer abdominal cases where you're going to need increased opioid. Typically for dosing of this, you can give an upfront bolus of around 1 to 1.5 milligrams per kilogram. If you think about that, let's take a normal, 70 kilogram patient. That's going to mean you're going to be giving them 70 to roughly 100 milligrams of lidocaine. So you can just use that as your induction dose prior to intubation. Typically, we're going to be giving the lidocaine with our induction meds anyways, and whether you give 40, 60, 100, just keep in mind that you could just do this bolus upfront just simply by incorporating that into your induction sequence. Next, the infusion aspect of this is usually 1 to 4 milligrams per minute, depending on the weight of the patient. And there's all types of charts out there, and those will vary depending on where you practice. But depending on the weight of the patient, you can give, again, anywhere from 1 to 4 milligrams per minute. This is where it changes a little bit. And I think this is just, again, where you practice, the type of structure and the type of support you have from other areas in the hospital, because this is kind of a joint effort with PACU. And then also depending on, where they're going to stay, if they're going to stay in the hospital. But for patients that are going to stay in the hospital after their procedure, you can drop the lidocaine drip by half while they go to PACU. And then you can actually run that for 24 hours after the procedure. And that's really where they've seen really good pain reduction. But again, that takes a lot of coordination with not only PACU, but then also making sure orders are written so that when they get to ICU or they're staying on the floor, wherever they are, that they get the max benefit from this lidocaine infusion. I worked at some places where we'll run it intraoperatively, and then it's basically cut as soon as they get to PACU. And just if you read the literature, you're just missing out on a lot of the benefits of that lidocaine infusion. And so, again, this is some things are out of your control, but this would be ideal if you could, again, cut it in half when you go to PACU, and then you can run that up to 24 hours. One of the nice things that we just came across as we were preparing for this to just mention is that in the postoperative period, running lidocaine will decrease your risk of laryngospasm after extubation. This makes total sense, and it's probably not a huge deal. I don't think that we're out looking for like cutting edge ways to stop everybody who's having laryngospasms in PACU. And this is, like our great solution for that problem, but it is just another thing to keep in mind that it does have that effect. It also will have some sedative effect. We know that with lidocaine that you'll have a little bit of sedation. So that's just something to keep in mind, that's a normal finding.
I really did not use many lidocaine drips during my anesthesia schooling and clinical use. But really, when I started my job at the current place I'm at, that's like the main protocol they use for any large abdominal case. And I was blown away by how well it worked. Just the amount of stability I saw with vital signs. I had very limited amounts of peaks and valleys in the vital signs. It just seemed that these longer cases were more leveled out. There were more railroad tracks when it came to the blood pressure and heart rate. Again, this isn't 100% on this, but it really was surprising to me how successful this was. The only negative thing that I personally have seen from using this is it does, as Tanner said, the sedative effect. So if you don't turn the drip down enough, or if you have it too high all the way through a long case and you go to extubate, there might be still pretty sleepy afterwards. But really the other thing that I've really seen is hypotension from this, not drastic by any means. But if I do have a little bit heavier of a patient and I'm having to run this based on the weight-based protocol. Let's say I'm up to 3.5-4 milligrams per minute on this patient. And I really have started to see a little bit of decrease in blood pressure to the point where I'm continually having to give pushes of something to get the blood pressure back up. So if that's the case, I actually will just wean back on the lidocaine drip, maybe closer to 2-2.5 if I started pretty high. And that seems to have been the happy medium for me. But really, this has been an amazing drug that I've added to my tool belt of anesthetics. Is for a lot of these big cases now that are going to be long open abdominal cases, I'll use this for. So another thing I want to talk about, and we've already really detailed went through this in two of our other episodes, is the idea of using a peripheral nerve block to minimize the amount of narcotics that you would need during a case. And this is by and large a wonderful way to limit narcotics. I'm a huge fan of doing peripheral nerve blocks. Depending on the anatomical location of what the procedure you're going to be doing, there's almost always a peripheral nerve block that can be used to decrease some type of surgical sensation that would be occurring at the surgical site. An example of this would be, let's say you're doing a shoulder procedure. Obviously, you'd be using an interscalene block here. It would numb up that area. It's a great block. I use this all the time when we're doing shoulder procedures. It basically prevents them from having any surgical response to the actual surgical procedure. And so I'll only give a touch of fentanyl just for induction, and I don't do anything after that. I mean, I even run my gas super low just because they're going to be sitting in that beach chair position. I know they're going to have decreased blood flow to the brain from that standpoint. And so I usually don't have to use as much of a neo drip because I just run them pretty low on their gas and they are just comfy and calm after getting this peripheral nerve block. And so that's just one example, but you can use this for lots of different places on the body. Again, go to look at our other episodes, go through those episodes. We talked through all the different types of common peripheral nerve blocks that you can use, both upper and lower. But basically the thing that we want to mention here is that the local anesthetic that you use, depending on which one you choose, can last for hours up to even days, depending on which one is put into the block. And the result of that, not only is during the procedure you're using less opioids, but the main benefit, I think, is in the postoperative setting. And Tanner, you may have more to add on this as well, but if you're using a medication that's going to last for, you know, 48 to 96 hours, that's a very important time where the patient would otherwise be having around-the-clock narcotics to manage their pain, which then you have all the side effects such as constipation, you're not going to be ambulating as much, you might have nausea, vomiting, and now we've just gotten rid of all of that because they are pain-free for the most part with this block for the first couple of days after their procedure, and they're able to have a better recovery from that standpoint. So I think it has so many benefits to offer, and in all honesty, very minimal side effects. I mean, for the local anesthetics that you give, there's very minimal side effects from that, depending on if you're safely injecting it. And now with commonly the gold standard is to use ultrasounds for these placements, there's a very low risk now of having these complications occur because we can know exactly where we're injecting our local anesthetic medication. But Tanner, I know you do a lot more blocks in your practice, so I'll let you add in anything you want to add here.
Yeah, I think the one hang up on this is honestly like patient participation. And this is something that oftentimes when you tell them that you're going to do a nerve block, they get maybe a little bit squirrely about, unless they've had one before. I feel like every patient that's had one before, they're like, oh yeah, I've had this before. Absolutely. Like they're all about it. I've not run into anybody who's had one before who has not wanted one again. But if it's their first time getting a nerve block, sometimes they're maybe a little squirrely just because they think that there's, you know, increased risk. And that's our job to explain all the different side effects and all the different things. But for me, I just tell them, like you mentioned, Cole, you're going to get pain relief longer than any kind of medications that I can give you. So that's the first thing I tell them, like the pain relief that you're going to get from this is going to be longer than the pain meds that I can give you. Obviously we can manage it with pain meds, but this is going to last, you know, 12, 14, up to 24 hours with typically the local anesthetic that I'm using. And so that's just going to, again, give them better pain relief. And, you know, patients are always all about that. The other thing I tell them is that it's not going to take away your pain completely. Like if we're doing, like you mentioned, an interscalene block, that's probably going to have a pretty dense block for the shoulder during the procedure. but it's not always going to take away their pain completely. You think about doing like an adductor canal block for a knee. It's going to have some pain relief, but it's not going to take away their pain completely. And so I always like to tell them that our goal is to be around like 50% pain reduction with our nerve block. If we can get that, you're still going to need pain medications. You're still going to need other things. But if we can get 50% reduction in pain, that I feel like that's a successful block. And then you're not having to take as many medications. You mentioned all the side effects, Cole, about like early ambulation and difficulty with GI motility, all things that we can have with, you know, increased dosing of meds. And so again, I think just setting it up ahead of time with the patients, if they are a little nervous about it, just explaining why we're going to use it, the extent of pain relief that they're going to probably see from it, both the intensity and duration. And then also just talking about, I always just say like, hey, the needle we're using is super small. We get to see it on ultrasound. We also do a lot of nerve stimulation too. So you're doing, you know, two checks to make sure that you're in the right spot. And yeah, I feel like people that have had them love them and they are so thankful for them. And then the people that, you know, haven't had them, I understandably might be a little bit scary, but there's so many fun blocks that you can do. And so many, it seems like almost every procedure that you do that you can figure out some way or another to do some sort of block. And so I think it's just a really, really awesome way to supplement your anesthetic plan. Kind of piggybacking off of that, the other thing that you could do is neuraxial anesthesia. So you could do this often in addition to peripheral nerve blocks. If you're doing like a, obviously like a total knee or something like that, you could do spinal. And then you could also do, we mentioned like a adductor canal block. You could do an IPAC block, whatever you'd like to do with your spinal to give them longer pain relief. But this is also something that is really nice. Like Cole mentioned, when you're using a peripheral nerve block, you're using less medications intraoperatively. And this is especially true with neuraxial anesthesia. If you're doing a spinal, you know, you basically need nothing to keep them comfortable while you're doing a total knee or a hip, or basically you need enough to keep them comfortable lying on a bed. And you can do that with just, you know, a light Mac, or if you have somebody who's really gung-ho and they just want to lay there, honestly, it's more about like the sound and the comfort on the bed than anything else. You're going to get a very obviously dense block from doing the spinal anesthetic. Depending on the length of the procedure, you can change up the type of local anesthetic that you use. Also, you're going to want to change the amount of volume that you're going to use, both depending on how long the procedure is going to be. And then also you want to obviously look at your specific patient and tailor that to their height, and knowing that, you know, every patient is different and specific. So again, we're not going to go into very much detail here. If you go over to our neuraxial anesthesia discussion, we talk about that and epidurals, that's going to be a much more in-depth discussion. But so again, we just wanted to basically mention this here when we're talking about what are the different ways that we can manage pain. And this is just another really, really great tool that we can use. The thing that I really like about the spinal, and then it holds true also for peripheral nerve blocks, is that it's not like an all or nothing situation. So I think this is nice for patients too, because you think about having a procedure done, and then, you know, if you're using narcotics, you're obviously titrating that to the respirations. You're making sure that they're comfortable, but there's still some element of when you get to PACU, you're kind of like, there's no like hard, fast rule. Like, have I covered their pain enough? Is this patient going to wake up and just be like, you know, my arm is killing me. And what's, I think, really nice about spinals, and if you're doing a peripheral nerve block, is they're going to wear off slowly. And it's not just going to be like all of a sudden that all wears off at the exact same time and they feel like the full sensation of the pain. And so it's nice because you can start to work in your pain meds, or you can work in your other adjuncts kind of slowly as they're starting to feel that pain sensation return. And so I think that's just another thing to mention here, that, you know, typically your spinals are going to last, you know, a couple of hours. And then you're also going to want to keep, you know, pay attention, because that's not going to, you know, last indefinitely, obviously. And so you're going to want to start working in your other pain management interventions as they're starting to feel things. And even before, just to kind of bridge that gap as they start to start to get more feeling back. And then obviously that pain's going to be right behind. So, but again, I think that's just nice that you're able to not have like an all or nothing scenario, but you're able to kind of slowly work in those other adjuncts, those other pain management interventions.
And also piggybacking off of both the peripheral nerve blocks and neuraxial anesthesia, there is something that I've kind of come across in the last few months. And that's the idea of, let's say you have a patient that has, continuing off of our shoulder procedure, let's say you have an interscalene block and you know the patient is going to be comfortable. You're assuming if the block is successful, the patient will be comfortable and you don't expect to need any narcotics throughout the case. And you're going to have a lasting effect for a couple of days after that. So you're really not expecting any narcotics. The only narcotics that you're expecting to have to give would be on induction. We typically, at least I typically, in my practice, give fentanyl before I go ahead and intubate the patient. And I do that just simply blunt the sympathetic response to that intubation. And I've had several CRNAs talk to me about in this situation, or maybe you have a very elderly patient, you're not willing to give too much narcotic to, you're afraid maybe of dropping the blood pressure or the cardiac reserve of this patient, and you want to limit the amount of narcotics that you're giving on induction. And one of the ways that you can do for both of these examples is to give Esmolol or an LTA kit on induction. And what I mean by that, I think we've all heard of an LTA kit. It's where you go ahead and you inject lidocaine right down through the cords when you're doing a DL or a video laryngoscopy of a patient. Before you put the tube through, you go ahead and you can inject that lidocaine right there and then, and that blunts the reflexes there. The other thing you can do, though, is to give Esmolol. And while in no way, shape, or form does this have pain control, what I've noticed, I've done this a few times and it's worked pretty successfully, is that you can give up to about a half a milligram per kilogram of Esmolol. It has a very fast onset, about 2 minutes, and a short duration. And we're only talking about 10 minutes long. And you can use this during your induction to limit that sympathetic response, that rise in heart rate that's associated with intubation. So again, maybe it's something where you don't expect to give any opioids throughout the rest of the case. And if you want to just go completely opioid free, this is a way that you can do that. You can do this or the LTA kit or even both. It's metabolized very quickly by non-specific plasma esterases. And so this is just going to get out of their system right away. So in the few times that I've given it, I've actually liked it because not only does it prevent that rise in heart rate, but that if you think about it, that's just a very temporary sympathetic stimulation when you put that tube through the cords. And while they're asleep, they're not really going to remember that pain. That pain's not going to be lasting at all. So all you're really doing is blunting that pain response briefly. So with the Esmolol, it just not gets rid of that pain, but it blunts the rise in heart rate. But the nice thing is it wears off very quickly so that when they settle back down and you're in that lull between induction and then incision, it actually prevents or helps minimize the amount of drop in your blood pressure and heart rate afterwards. I guess just blood pressure. It prevents the drop in blood pressure afterwards because it doesn't linger around like the fentanyl would.
All right, NSAIDs. So this will be the next thing that we want to talk about. NSAIDs, typically you think Toradol, ibuprofen, these are COX inhibitors. These will reduce prostaglandin synthesis and this will reduce the inflammation. So again, I would encourage you to go back to the pain pathway discussion and just listen to that because we think about all the different areas that we can attack the pain pathway. And this is going to be basically right at the beginning with these prostaglandins and trying to limit the amount of inflammation and then the amount of transmission to the pain pathway. So this is where the NSAIDs are going to work. They're going to be metabolized through the renal system. They can cause bone fractures. So if you have somebody who has very weak bones, osteoarthritis, and you're concerned about that, this would be something that you'd want to avoid. You do not want to give these in patients with asthma because they can induce a reaction there. And they could also cause stomach ulcers and GI bleeding. There's some people after they've had gastric bypass surgery, they're told not to have any NSAIDs. And so this would just be something to keep in mind with that increased risk for stomach ulcers. Onsets is typically about 30 minutes, lasts for about 4 to 6 hours. You can dose ibuprofen about 400 to 800 milligrams every 6 to 8 hours. Toradol is more what I use, and you can give 30 to 60 milligrams. I usually stick with either 15 or 30. And again, you can give that towards the end of the case. That way it's onset there within about the 30 minutes, and then you get that duration of action while they're actually there recovering from the procedure. Celebrex is another one that we typically will see. It's different in the fact that it selectively will block the COX-2 inhibitors, which gives us the desired pain control. And then it will also minimize the side effects that you see when you're blocking the COX-1 receptors. As a result, this will have a lower risk for GI issues or hypersensitivity reaction with your asthmatic patients. Typically, you're going to dose this around 400 milligrams orally, and you'll give this prior to surgery. This is usually part of like the cocktails that we'll give before they will go back to surgery. But again, this just has a few things that are nicer about the Celebrex than if you're going to be giving like the Toradol, the ibuprofen. Tylenol, you can either give this oral or IV. IV Tylenol is money and is incredible. It's just very expensive, and I feel like it's hard to get your hands on. And it's hard to justify using just because it is so expensive. Has a significant opioid sparing effect. It does not result in significant GI and cardiovascular side effects that you see with NSAIDs. The hepatotoxicity concern that you see typically is going to be with doses over 4,000 milligrams a day. I know I would see this with like, if you're recovering hearts, you could be giving these IV Tylenol. I just feel like it made the world of difference for their pain control. But again, that 4,000 milligrams a day, that's really where you're going to be considering the hepatotoxicity concerns. If you're going to be giving this for pediatrics, typically you'll dose this at 15 milligrams per kilogram, and this will be up to 1,000 milligrams. Again, if you're doing the IV Tylenol for children.
And this IV Tylenol is something that, again, I didn't really do during my clinical rotations while in school. But when I started working at the facility I'm at now, this is something, again, that they had in protocol, and it's been wonderful. I typically give it in like ortho trauma cases where, again, I don't want to give a ton of opioids to, or maybe it's just something that they have a really bad fracture and I know it's going to be severely painful. And I'm going to give still a bunch of opioids, but I want to spread out with some different avenues of pain control. IV Tylenol up front has been a miracle worker. And that's, again, just from my personal practice, what I've seen. But again, I usually just for an adult patient, give up to a gram, just drip that in up front. And it really has, I think, has made a big difference in my practice. The last thing we want to talk about is gabapentin and pregabalin. And these inhibit pain transmission and central sensitization by binding to the voltage-gated calcium channels in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. And these are especially good to give early in the preoperative setting. Or you can give gabapentin anywhere from 300 milligrams to 1200 milligrams. And that's, you know, can be even up to a day before the procedure, just because it takes several hours. Gabapentin can sometimes even take up to 24 hours to really have a good effect. So I know some places give it the night before to patients. But again, it can make some sedative type effects to the patients. So from that standpoint, typically, at least the places that I've been to, wait until the morning of, and they give that right away in the preoperative setting. And no way, shape, or form is this all-encompassing. There's obviously many other ways that are many different other medications that we can use to limit the amount of pain that patients will experience. But these are some of the main ones that we've come across, things that we've seen that have worked for us. We know there are some controversial topics with some of the medications. Some people, for whatever reason they have, choose not to do that in their practice. And again, that's the beauty of anesthesia. I say this almost every episode. Anesthesia is an art. It's just as much of an art as it is science. And that's because there are so many different avenues and so many different cocktails that you can put together to make your anesthetic plan. And again, we want to do this episode just to give you more things to put in your tool belt, more ideas that you can use, things that you have at your disposal that you can provide to provide adequate pain management to these patients while also minimizing the amount of opioids and potential side effects that they would have for those going forward.